Session number 5190.
Lieutenant Colonel Luckin, Tape 3. So you were saying that the Japanese, the British submarines used to patrol around the coast.
Yeah.
Where did they used to stop?
Well, they used to go up to Wei or Fuzhou, Shanghai, etc. and so forth. And generally pay courtesy calls all the way around, probably go down as far as the Philippines and say how do to the Yanks, etc. and so
Yes.
forth. It's the same as the American naval forces would look in, you know, in and out the whole of the time.
And did they pay courtesy calls to the Japanese?
Oh yes, no, nominally everything was quite okay. But at the time that I arrived there, of course, they were beginning to, the powers that be, probably at home and in the colony, were beginning to realize that that practically nothing had ever been done in the way of permanent defences for Hong Kong. And it was decided to do something about it, which was one of the reasons where in one, up till the time that I went out there, there had only been one surveyor of works out there with the CRE. They stepped it up to three, but that only lasted for about 6 months, and one was sent to Singapore. Left two of us there. And we embarked on, for those days, it was quite an intensive scheme of strengthening the defences. One of the first things we did was to cut a road out, right out to the tip of the Stanley Peninsula, which figures a lot in the Japanese war histories because that's where they had the interned all the women and children from Hong Kong out in Stanley. We cut a road out there. We built two barrack blocks out there. We built some four or five married quarters of various types. And we put in the first two-gun battery of 9-inch guns at Stanley Point. We also built a pier out there so that stores could be taken round by sea and offloaded instead of having to haul them right over the hump of Hong Kong Island. This is rather like a whale back. And it meant the stores had to be unloaded in the harbour and then hauled up over the hump and down the other side, whereas take them round by sea, a comparatively simple matter. We then put a there was one 6-inch battery, I think, of fairly ancient make, overlooking the Lai Ming Channel, which is the main entrance to Hong Kong Harbour, the two. And that was replaced by a new battery. We then put a new 6-inch battery up on top of Collinson's Peak, which was on the opposite side of that, on the Kowloon side, the mainland side. We put in some new searchlights in Green Island. And we put another battery out there. I forget the name of the darn thing now. It doesn't really matter. On the side of the island faces directly, of course, to the Portuguese Macau on that side. We built some magazines in Stonecutters Island. We put searchlights on Green Island. And then over on the new territories, the great thing there was the question of access. There was only one road that went up more or less the side of the Pearl River up to a place called Castle Peak, and then cut across the peninsula, following the boundary between us and China proper. And that was the only access up there at all, except tracks, known as the Grass Cutters Pass and Cooley Pass, etc. and so forth. And there's a big ridge of, well, really hills, more than mountains, known as the Dragon's Back, which runs at the back of Kowloon Peninsula. And we built a road up to Cairns Peak, and then right along the dragon's back, so that it was possible to get troops, trucks, guns, etc., if you were possible, up onto the ridge at the top, which had never been feasible before. We also constructed a whole lot of heavy machine gun posts up there, which were very nicely camouflaged, etc., and so forth, but very largely it was done, one I'd say, with your tongue in your cheek, because it was always realised that Hong Kong was, as was later proved, practically indefensible unless you'd got command of the sea. The simple main reason being water. There are no wells or of any description on Hong Kong Island itself. What water was collected there would be collected during the summer season in tanks cut into the granite. There were no wells, no rivers as such, etc., and so forth. But there was a certain amount of water available over in Kowloon, and there, just about the time I got there, they had finished building the Tsing Moon Dam. Now, the water from there was piped across under the harbour and over to Hong Kong Island. And it was obvious whoever controlled Tsing Moon controlled the island. They could simply cut the water supply off, and that was that. But we did do an enormous amount of work there. It really was all based on that the defence mainly would rest with the Navy. If the Navy couldn't keep command of the seas, then you'd be impossible to hold out there if there was an attack. And I think it was beginning to sink into people in the know that inevitably it was going to come sometime. Whether it would come from the Japanese or whether it would come from a completely communist China, nobody really knew, but I felt that it would come sooner or later.
What sort of dates do you think that fear began to sink in, or that suspicion?
It was roughly about, I probably started probably with the invasion of Manchuria, which I think was about 1932. By the time I got there in about 34, which is a couple of years later, you know, well, 2 years is nothing to governments trying to think about something, and they would decide, and then they better do something.
Yes.
And of course, like everything else, that you only had limited amount of money, and just do the best you could with what we'd got.
So you mentioned all the various works you did. Can you sort of tell me something about your daily routine? What was it like?
Well, are you talking now from a personal point of view? Really?
Well, from a military point of view to start with.
Well, no, you see, I'm not, because you've got to appreciate that my job was purely a specialist job. That I was chief surveyor of works to the chief engineer. My responsibility was for all contract work, drawing up contracts, going out to tender, vetting them when you got them in, vetting deviations, all bills, finance, everything came through my office. A certain amount of technical supervision and advice to the works officers, etc., and so forth, which of course is entirely different to the life of a man in an infantry battalion or in a unit. Completely different.
How much of your time did you spend on office work? And
I should say roughly about 80% of my time would be, 75% of my time. Of working time, that's 75%, and the other 25% I would necessarily be out and about having a look at the work and see what was going on, what they, and checking it, etc., and so forth, to see if, you know, there was no, everything was going as it should go, and there was no jiggery pokey going on, or anything. So it's an entirely different life from that led by, say, an officer in an infantry battalion, or even, say, our own fortress company. You know, they'd got their own duties there, manning the searchlights and keeping them clean and testing them, trying them, and one thing. They also had a complete Chinese half company, all Chinese, that they were trained to operate the searchlights and keep them clean and that.
They were part of the British Army, but then.
Were sort of almost unofficially, put it that way.
And how were they recruited?
Recruited locally, yeah. Mm.
And they had a British Army uniform.
Yes.
You said to me when we spoke before that even as an engineer you were first and foremost a soldier. What sort of things did you do to keep your military prowess?
Well, only that what we did was purely voluntary, etc. and so forth. But I mean, we used to have a few exercises occasionally up on the rifle range or the revolver range, and beyond keeping yourself physically fit. Apart from that, there was really nothing much you could do.
You didn't go on manoeuvres or anything like
that? Well, you see, you wouldn't get manoeuvres. You couldn't get manoeuvres in a place like that. Hong Kong is a very, very restricted land. The whole blinking island, Hong Kong Island, is only about 5 miles long and 3 miles wide, you can't have. And the terrain on the... and the new territories, as they call it, was not particularly suitable for that sort of thing. They did go out and, you know, exercise themselves on all sorts of company and battalion operations, but you couldn't do anything on a big scale. In any case, there were not sufficient troops to do anything on a big scale. They might have... do a little bit of cooperation with the Navy, perhaps a couple of destroyers would just have to all coordinate beforehand with a couple of destroyers or something. They would try and creep into the harbour or something, see if the searchlights could pick them up in time, or they'd try and put one of the cruisers that are around, they might try and put a marine detachment ashore, the idea of trying to capture one of the batteries, etc. and so forth, just to test whether the system of alerts worked, etc. and so forth.
How frequently did that happen?
Oh, I shouldn't think any more than about once in 4 months or something like that. It was on a very small scale, really. It was a very small garrison.
To go back to your works, can you tell me something about how you arranged contracts with contractors?
Well, basically, according to the book, it was done exactly the same as it's done at home here. That, I mean, you would have, you prepared your own drawings, your own specifications, etc., etc., for what you required. There were, in the colony and one another, a number of quite good building contractors, mainly Chinese, although I think there was a great deal of Japanese money behind them as well. And so one did exactly the same as they did here. We just went out to tender, so we wanted a new barrack block built there. We drew up the plans, we drew up the specification, we produced the bills of quantities. We selected the firms that we were going to ask to tender for it, and we simply sent out and asked them to submit their offer by a certain date. That was where, of course, we then began to run into difficulties, because if you do things in this country, as there were in those days, of course you send out all these documents, the contractor normally prices his bills of quantities, you see. He then sends in his tender form, but he retains the price bills of quantities, so that one simply scrutinizes the tender, and normally speaking, say that you've got the tenders have come in from a dozen firms, unless there's something obviously wrong, we would take the lowest one. I'm now talking about Great Britain or UK, and he would take the lowest one and write to him or phone him and tell him, I want to see your bills of quantities. He would then have to send those bills in, you see. One, we wanted to see that the total in his BQ agreed with what he'd got on his tender, and we'd go right through his arithmetic account, his prices, etc., and so forth, to see that there was nothing radically wrong with it, etc., and so forth. And having satisfied yourself on all that, of course, you simply notify that he'd got the tender and he'd get the order to start work, etc., and so forth. And now in China, that was where our difficulty arose, because it was always a mystery to me how they did it. But we would say, ask half a dozen firms to tender for a particular job and say whether your tender has to be in by a certain time on a certain date. And they were supposed to send them in by post. They're supposed to be dropped in the tender box, unopened, until the tender officers arrived, which would be myself and the chief engineer, because we had two keys to the tender box, and you couldn't open it on your own, and we scheduled them, and then you went on from there. But the trouble was, they wouldn't send them on the post. That if I said that they were to be in at 10 o'clock on such and such a day, I would probably arrive at my office at 9 o'clock on that particular day, and by 10 o'clock these half dozen contractors were all sitting on the steps. And the best that we could do is that they would call them in one at a time, and they certainly had put a figure on the tenderman, and he would just say, $25,000. Can do. That's all he knows is can do. And the next bloke might come in and say, $27,000 can do, etc., etc. It was all very illegal. That was the best we could do. Well, there, of course, quite everything, you were reasonably satisfied. You would get hold of the lowest fella and said, all right, now, you've got to fill your bill of quantities in, you've got to price it. Explained to him very carefully. I had an Australian Chinese interpreter who was a very good chap. Explained to them that they had got to price the bills of quantities, and that's where the fun started, you see, because they should have been done before. Well, they'd go away and they'd carefully explain to them that when they'd finished this, that the two figures must tally, the one in the bill of quantities and the one on the tender form must tally. When they brought them back, they did. But how it tallied was really, absolutely farcical. Because they simply put figures in and rubbed them out again and kept putting them in, figuring out probably over a bill of quantities about that thick, until they eventually arrived as an answer at the back, which tallied. It would be full of the most ridiculous things imaginable. You would find on one page that he was quite prepared to give you 3 inches of concrete, you know, for $6 a square yard, and then you find that he was going to give you 6 inches of concrete for about $2 a square yard. And then we had to patiently go all through this and try to get him to, until we got something that looked reasonably good and said, all right, the contract's yours.
Did you ever find that some of the contracts were far lower than you would have thought possible?
Yes, And that mainly arose from labour. Labour, there was plenty of labour available, in a sense. But it arose from the labour because there were no really fixed rates. There were no such things as trade unions or anything like that. That the contractor simply obtained his labour in the cheapest possible market. And on several occasions we found that they got extremely low, and we queried as to how it could be possible to do these things there. We found that it was quite a common practice that in other parts of China, where possibly they had had an extremely bad harvest or bad floods, etc. and so forth, the contractor would go up there and sort of engage the whole of the village and bring them down to work for him for practically nothing at all. He simply accommodated and fed them, etc. and so forth. At the end of the job, he might give them a few dollars, etc. and so forth, and take them back home again. But there was really nothing we could do about that.
So you had to turn a blind eye?
Well, yes. I mean, he wasn't breaking any law in any way. He was simply obtaining the labour in the cheapest possible market.
And were you allowed to give contracts to Japanese companies at all?
There was no embargo as such, but neither were there any actual Japanese companies working at, except in one house, and that is, which is a very serious one, that the one and only cement works in the area was owned by a Japanese company. So we had to buy our cement from them anyway. Yeah. Of course, I couldn't afford to get it shipped out from home. It would be much too expensive altogether. And that was unavoidable. But they'd got a complete monopoly anyway. That was the only one that did make cement.
And the Japanese were quite prominent in the business community generally, were they?
Oh, very much so, yes.
Yes. It was impossible to avoid dealing with them.
Oh, you couldn't avoid dealing with them either.
But on the whole, did you prefer to deal with Chinese or Japanese contractors?
As a matter of fact, I can't remember ever having to deal direct with any of the Japanese at all. Except insofar as argue over the price of cement, etc. and so forth, but there's not a contractor as such, who's only really arguing with either. But they couldn't drive the price too high because they knew very well there wasn't an enormous margin that we could. You see, cement in this country would only be about a quarter of the price that it was out there. So that they hadn't got too much of a margin because you would have paid you to ship it out.
Yes. So in your were your contacts with Chinese people limited to business contacts on the whole?
Oh yes, all sort of building contracts, road contracts, water supply, every model. Much the same as you would do here if you were running a town in this country.
Did those contacts ever spill over and become social contacts?
No. Yeah. Not that I'm no, because you might the two sides, put it that way, the European side and the Chinese side, practically didn't meet on a social level at all. That very, very sort of strict. Well, I won't say strict. There were the dividing lines. There was nothing to stop you having Chinese friends or the Chinese friends having you as a friend. Nothing at all. But, you just didn't meet, in a sense that the military and the services tended to use their own clubs and sporting facilities, etc. and so forth. And the Chinese that were that way minded, they had their own places. And of course all the civilian employees in the dockyards and Trinity House and so on, etc. Docks and harbour boards, they had their own places. There wasn't a great deal of mixture at all.
You had a Chinese houseboy, didn't you?
Yes, well, that was simply because in the main there were no quarters available for anybody, and we simply lived in service flats. And there, of course, the flat and all the meals and every mortal thing were provided by the proprietor of the flat. And they also employed the houseboys. They paid them a certain amount. But each houseboy either had one or two probably families to look after, and he had to keep the flats clean and make the beds and do all that, and he also acted as your batman, you know, and came around in the morning and cleaned your buttons and did that more, all those odd jobs, cleaned the shoes and, you know.
So what were the facilities like for enjoyment? There was the club, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, very, on the whole, very good, because you had the United Services Club, which had facilities, I suppose, was probably like a couple of dozen tennis courts, squash courts, billiard rooms, etc. and so forth. The civil people had the same thing. The Navy made the use of them, as happens, was the United Services. There's personally, there's quite a lot of sailing went on with the Royal Hong Kong Yacht Club. I had a half share in a boat out there, which was fairly successful. There was one or two silver pots in the other room that I won with it. And I used to do quite a lot of swimming, because I had always done a certain amount of long-distance swimming, and although I was still getting a bit ancient, I was still playing water polo for the Royal Engineer team, and there was plenty of facilities for that.
Did you meet other European people socially?
Oh, yes. Yes, mainly the people that worked for the Docks and Harbour Board, and of course Trinity House had people out there. Then there was the Customs and Excise, police and so on.
Yes.
All the senior ranks, of course, were all British or European origin, etc. Oh, yes, you met all those.
What sort of frequency of leave was there, and what did you?